Welcome to the Long COVID podcast with me, Jackie Baxter. I am really excited to bring you today's episode. Please do check out the links in the show notes where you can find the podcast website, social media and support group, as well as a link to buy me a coffee if you are able. You should not rely on any medical information contained in this podcast and related materials in making medical, health-related or other decisions. Please do consult a doctor or other health professional. I love to hear from you. If you've got any suggestions or feedback or just want to say hey, then please do get in touch. I really hope you enjoy this episode, so here we go. Hello and welcome to this episode of the Long COVID podcast. I am absolutely delighted to welcome back Professor Louise Cummings. We spoke about just over 2 years ago, as it turns out. I was looking earlier and I could not believe how long it was, about Louise's research into cognitive and linguistic difficulties in people with long COVID. I hope I got that right. And she has been continuing with this research and doing all sorts of other amazing things. So we're going to take a bit of a dive into all of that today. So a very warm welcome back to the podcast, Louise.
Thank you very much, Jackie. It's lovely to be with you for a second time.
Yeah, it's been amazing catching up with you as well. So to start with, would you mind just giving a very brief kind of introduction to what it is that you do before we start diving into the research side of it?
Okay, so my research and teaching areas at the Hong Kong Polytechnic University are clinical linguistics and communication disorders. So my background is actually in speech language pathology. So I'm interested in how language, speech, communication break down in people with a range of medical problems. And quite early on in the pandemic, around October 2020, I became aware that a significant number of people were not making a good recovery from their COVID infection. And at that point, I started to collect a lot of data, and I've really been working on long COVID ever since then. So I'm here today primarily to talk about the follow-up study that I did to the initial study, which was featured in our first podcast together.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. And I will drop a link to that first episode. I think it's at 16 or 18, I think. So it's right back at the start. So that one's really, really interesting. And that will give you a load more information on the original study and as well the results from the original study as well, which we were able to share at the time. Certainly some of those results, which was really exciting to hear. So maybe you would give just a sort of brief recap of that study, and you know, folk can go back and listen to the episode for more details of that, but yeah, maybe just a kind of quick overview would be good.
So I mean, the initial study, there were six groups in the design of the study. We'll concentrate on just two of those six groups because those are the groups that are most relevant to the follow-up piece of work that I did. So in the initial study, Jackie, I examined 69 people who had COVID infection, and at that stage were reporting that they weren't making a good recovery. And there was also a healthy adult group there, 26 healthy participants. So all the participants in the study and across all the six groups, they undertook a series of 12 language tasks. And these were obviously recorded online because this was at the height of the pandemic. And what I found very clearly was that people with long COVID, or 69 participants with long COVID, they were really struggling quite significantly on seven of those 12 language tasks. So I'll just recap what the areas of difficulty were. So people with long COVID were struggling with both immediate and delayed verbal recall. One of the tasks that I gave them to do was a picture description task. So I showed them a scene, it's called the cookie theft picture description task, and they struggled to produce an informative description of that particular scene. And then I also give the participants two other discourse production tasks. One is where they were telling a story based on a sequence of six pictures, and another is where they were recounting a fictional narrative. And both of those discourse production tasks, performance in those, were reduced as well. And then there were two fluency tasks, a letter fluency task and a category fluency task, where participants with long COVID were struggling also. So there were seven of the 12 tasks where people with long COVID were really having considerable difficulty relative to the healthy participants in the study.
Yeah, and I think if I remember correctly, the areas where they struggled more was using certain, now if I see if I can get the terminology right, and I probably won't, that certain different parts of the brain and different sort of elements of speech and language, I suppose, that required more different parts of the brain working together. Was that anything close to what meant?
Yes, kind of. I mean, the discourse production tasks, which featured heavily in the study, so I was examining the informativeness of speakers' discourse, how much information participants were able to convey through language. And the adults with long COVID tended to produce less informative discourse. Now, that can occur for a range of reasons. There may be memory deficits, which mean they couldn't remember certain bits of information to relate in a story, for example, or they were maybe struggling with a group of cognitive skills called executive functions, which allowed them to organise and plan a narrative. So telling a story is, you know, people think stories because you tell them to young children that they're a cognitively simple task. They're actually quite complex because, you know, to narrate a story, you've got to not just think about what needs to be said, but you've got to think about the order or sequence in which you say things. So the sequencing, the planning, the organization of narratives was also compromised in the adults with long COVID. So we, you know, we can think about the different types of cognitive skills that make those linguistic activities possible, but they certainly suggested a significant level of cognitive compromise in the adults with long COVID in the study.
Right. So it was the tasks where there was more going on, I suppose, to put it into more layman's terms.
Yes, it's where you have to be able to retain information, sequence and order information, and present information in a way to a listener whereby they can follow a story. So when you introduce maybe a character in the story, do you then make subsequent reference to that character in the story through appropriate pronouns, for example? And those sorts of higher level cognitive skills were particularly compromised in the adults with long COVID. They found those higher level tasks more difficult to perform.
Yes, absolutely. And I think for a lot of the participants, this was the first time that someone had said to them, here is an actual evidence of something that isn't working for you. So, you know, your bloods are fine, your cardiac what's-its fine, your lung scan's fine, all of the other tests that have been done on you, they're all coming back normal, so you're absolutely fine. But actually here in this study, in this testing that you did with them, there is something coming back here abnormal. So I think that sense of validation that people got from this, I think, was quite important for them, I think.
Yes, I mean, that in the sort of around October 2020, people knew they were not making a good recovery, but they were going through all the sort of standard medical tests. They were having bloods taken, they were having MRI scans, they were having, you know, chest x-rays, and every single test was coming back perfectly normal, no problem at all. But they knew they were unwell and that they weren't able to function. And I think you're right. I think it was particularly validating for people then to have something objective to show that they were struggling with tasks, which, you know, given the sort of educational background of these individuals and their occupational roles, we can safely assume they would have had no difficulty with whatsoever prior to their COVID infections.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it says something about the world in general that people should need that validation. But nonetheless, that is the way that it appears to be, unfortunately. So, yeah, I think that was huge. So let's dive into the follow-up study. And what kind of made you decide to do that? How did that come about?
Okay, so given that I'd established that there were these particular areas of language functioning that people with long COVID are really struggling with, I wanted to know, were these difficulties persisting over time, or were they, with further physical recovery from the infection, were they beginning to resolve spontaneously? So that was one of the primary reasons I did a 6-month follow-up study. So we needed to know what was going to happen with these difficulties. Were they going to be, quite resistant to change and still evident 6 months on from the first study, or were they going to improve spontaneously? So that was one of the reasons for the study. But then I also wanted to examine the employment impact of these difficulties. Because none of the people I was working with at that stage, in 2020, 2021, they had not been able to return to work. And I wanted to see what was the role that these cognitive linguistic difficulties were having in their employment and their ability to return to work. So those were the two main reasons why I decided to do the 6-month follow-up study.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think, again, it's going to vary for all sorts of people. But, if you are unable to function cognitively, it is going to affect, well, it's going to affect every aspect of your life in the same way that the other, symptoms of long COVID is going to impact every aspect of your life. But again, I mean, anecdotally, there were people talking about not being able to drive even short distances because it was dangerous for them to be doing so, which, means that their ability to care for children, to get to medical appointments, to do, all of these things that I guess people completely take for granted. Suddenly, you can't do any of these things, and you're even more reliant on other people to help. And some people have another person, and some people don't. And even those who do, it's still putting a lot onto that kind of support system, isn't it? So I think it can be underestimated.
And a lot of the participants in my study, Jackie, these were high functioning professional people before their infections. These were people working in healthcare roles, working in education, and these are demanding professional roles where you've really got to be firing on all cylinders to be able to perform your duties in these particular roles. So even a small degree of cognitive slippage for those individuals was having actually a devastating impact on them and their ability to return to work.
Yeah, definitely. So let's talk about the study. I'm just going to ask the really wide open question. How does it work? What did you do?
Okay, so the initial study had 69 long COVID participants, and what I did was I returned to those participants and basically said, look, are you willing and able 6 months after the first study to take part in a follow-up study? Now, some people were, they simply were maybe too unwell to participate in the follow-up study, or for timing purposes, they weren't able to meet the 6 month mark. So as long as people were willing and available to participate, they could take part. So out of the original 69, I was able to get 41 adults who were able to participate in the follow-up study. And I used again the healthy control group, 26 healthy adults, but there was a problem here. This study that was obviously being conducted at a time when there was a high prevalence of COVID infections. So out of my original 26 healthy participants, 15 of those people had gone on to develop COVID between the first and the second study. So I couldn't obviously use them then in the follow-up study. So what I did was I found education and gender matched individuals to take their place in the healthy control group. So there were 41 COVID adults, 26 healthy adults that had not had COVID, or at least had not tested positive for COVID at any point. And I basically went through the 12 language tasks again. Now, there were improvements. Okay, so we'll start with the two areas of ongoing difficulty. The verbal recall was still particularly difficult for the adults with long COVID. So both immediate and delayed verbal recall, there was still a significant difference between the COVID participants and the healthy adults. So that was an ongoing area of struggle for the adults with long COVID in the follow-up study. Now, on all the other language tasks, the COVID participants were performing similarly to the healthy adults. So there was some evidence of improvement there, even though verbal recall was still quite compromised for the adults with long COVID. But against that sort of backdrop as a general finding, there were still a lot of individual performances amongst the participants with long COVID, which were sort of troublesome and problematic. So, for example, on a confrontation naming task where I would show people pictures and ask them to name the pictures, you know, you can name the picture, but it might take you, you might go via a very long, circuitous route. And what I was finding was, although they were maybe able to get very high scores on that confrontation naming task, there was considerable cognitive struggle in getting to the target word. So that was, you know, that was a problem. You know, just getting the score in itself is not much good if there's considerable cognitive struggle in getting to that point. So even though they were able to hit the scores that were similar to the healthy adults in the study, there was still very marked cognitive struggle on the part of the adults with long COVID. There was a lot of what I call cognitive inefficiency. They couldn't just see a picture, you know, access their mental lexicon and pull out the word to name that picture. It was a laborious, effortful process for them.
Yeah, and this isn't just the kind of, oh, it's on the tip of my tongue, I can't remember that thing. You know, this is much more than that, I take it.
It is. And, you know, it was maybe happening on every single item in the test. So, you know, they may have named 19 of the 20 items correctly, but, you know, maybe on 15 of those items, they were really evidencing a lot of struggle to get the target word. So, you know, that's not normal naming, even though they were able to hit a fairly high level or a high score on a task like that.
We'll be right back. I'm interrupting myself for a second to tell you about long COVID breathing. The fabulous Vicky Jones and I have teamed up to bring you long COVID breathing. We are both passionate about sharing our expertise and experience of the breath and how incredibly helpful that can be with long COVID. We've worked together to develop a course that is specifically tailored to those with long COVID. It's a 6-week course with 12 sessions, all delivered online. The community feel and learning that we're all sharing is such a joy. To find out more information and to sign up for our courses, workshops and other shorter sessions, please check out the link below, longcovidbreathing.com, or email longcovidbreathing@gmail.com to start your breathing journey with us.
Yeah, and this is interesting because if we kind of take a look at sort of more physical stuff, just as an example, you know, you get things, the PIP assessments, so sort of disability benefits and those sorts of things, the sort of questions that they tend to ask, you know, can you walk 50 metres or whatever it is that they ask? And that's not really the question they should be asking. You know, a person might be able to walk 50 meters, but it might take them an hour and put them in bed for a week as a result of it. So yes, they can, but actually, no, they can't really. And, you know, what you're sort of saying is that in terms of test scores, you know, they may be scoring virtually the same, but that's not the full story. And, you know, looking at those other factors are as important, I think, you know, because, yeah, you know, some, if you compare two people and one can tell you, oh, that's a picture of a rabbit, and someone else is going to take 10 minutes to tell you it's a picture of a rabbit, those two scores may look the same on paper, but they're absolutely not.
Exactly. So it's not just getting the end result, it's the route that you take to the end result. And that route was very labored and difficult for many of the adults with long COVID. So they were getting the score, but their performance was still not what you would describe as a sort of normal naming performance, for example.
Yeah, but it is also interesting that a lot of things had improved. So that's obviously positive as well. You know, it's positive to take from it, isn't it?
Yes, we mustn't overlook the fact. And this, you know, that improvement occurred despite the fact, you know, these adults were not receiving rehabilitation. They weren't receiving any type of speech and language therapy, for example. So there was some degree of spontaneous improvement there. There's no doubt about that. But it still, at 6 months, was not what you would call a sort of normal performance. These individuals had certainly not returned to their pre-COVID state.
Yeah. I don't know if this is something you actually noted in the study or not, but I'm curious. You know, you said that they've not been receiving, you know, any meaningful healthcare. But were there things that they were doing aside to that? I'm thinking the sort of things that people are able to do themselves, like, you know, doing things like meditation and breathing and improving diet and, you know, all of these things that a lot of people have seen a lot of help from. Was there any element of that that you know of?
I mean, I think sort of every individual was doing his or her own thing to try and improve their symptoms. I think that was inevitable. You know, some people were pacing very well, other people were trying vitamins, other people were maybe using sort of brain training apps. So everybody was doing his or her own thing as a means of trying to improve their symptoms, but they didn't receive any sort of formal intervention as such. That's what I mean.
Yeah, which is kind of shocking in itself, isn't it, really?
Yeah, you know, it has been a period in healthcare where resources have been completely overwhelmed by the demand, where people have just, you know, not been able to get quite often the treatments and the interventions that they need.
Yeah, and people have been kind of hacking their way through it with, well, varying degrees of success, I suppose. So yeah, that's really interesting about the kind of results of that. And is that one of the links you've given me, isn't it?
It is. I've given you the link to the study. So I mean, it sets out the results in detail, but then there were also the employment outcomes in the study, and I think that's, you know, that was the second key objective in the study. So I think it's worth taking a look at some data for employment for the individuals in the study as well. So I mean, let's think about when this 6 month follow up study was conducted. The participants in the 6 month study were on average 21 months after the onset of their COVID infection. So we're talking about nearly 2 years on from the onset of their COVID infection. So what I did was I charted what was happening to them in terms of employment. So how many people were in employment before they developed COVID-19, and how many of them had been able to get back into employment by the stage of the follow-up study. So prior to their COVID infections, of the 41 adults, 37 were in employment. So 37 of the 41 were employed before their COVID-19 infection. At the 6 month follow-up study, only one of those 37 people had been able to return to what I'm calling their full pre-COVID occupational role. So their exact job, the exact role they were doing prior to their COVID infection. So just one of 37. So this is a very poor outcome, really, in terms of employment. Now, even the one who had returned, that was actually the youngest participant in the study. She was an 18-year-old student in full-time education. And even she, a month after her follow-up assessment, even she had to drop down to part-time education. So really, by the 6 month follow-up study, Jackie, the employment outcomes were not good at all for these individuals. Effectively, none of the people who had been in employment prior to COVID had been able to get back into the workplace. So I then investigated, well, if you haven't been able to return to your full pre-COVID occupational role, have you been able to return to any employment at all, even sort of part-time? And 11 of the 36 had been able to get back into some form of employment. So this was obviously reduced hours, maybe a less demanding role. So it wasn't their full pre-COVID employment role, but it was at least some form of employment. So that was 11 of 36. And unfortunately, 25 had no employment whatsoever. And, you know, some of them, 7 of them went on to get ill health retirement. 12 were living off social security benefits. So the picture on the whole was not particularly encouraging in terms of employment, that people so far on from the point of their initial infection were still not able to return to full-time employment or whatever occupational role they undertook prior to becoming unwell.
Yeah, again, you know, anecdotally, you know, you hear about a lot of people attempting to return to work and, you know, maybe sustaining it for a short period of time and then, you know, hitting a relapse and that being a problem or just not being able to sustain it. Do you know if the people that weren't working at all had been able to sort of try any returns to work, and it hadn't worked out, or had they just not been in a position where they were able to actually try at all?
They literally were unable to try. I mean, they were just still so unwell that they were unable to return. We can look at the factors that maybe played a role in that, but those people who were not able at the 6 month follow-up study to get back into work had literally not been able to even attempt to return to work. They were still really quite unwell at that stage.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, this is something that will differ person to person and job to job, role to role, depending on what their support systems at home may be like as well, and things. You know, if somebody had a supportive partner at home, for example, then that might make them more able to be able to do some hours. Whereas if they were having to do everything for themselves at home, then it's, you know, much more difficult for them to also then be able to do something else. You know, again, this comes back to the sort of pacing and things, doesn't it? That you know, until you become unwell with something like this, you're not really aware of how exhausting chores at home are.
Something that was very apparent to me was that even as physical symptoms were improving, so you may that maybe recovered from their breathlessness or that maybe recovered from their palpitations, I think actually the cognitive issues were the things that were keeping most of them out of the workplace. Those seem to be particularly persistent and they don't seem to resolve so quickly. So, the physical symptoms may have settled down to a large extent, but they were still struggling with the cognitive demands of their role. And, they just knew, for example, a healthcare worker, a nurse, a neonatal nurse, for example, said, there's absolutely no way I can return to the ward. I mean, and do the sort of multitasking that I would have been doing in my role before. So it was the cognitive demands of their role which tended to basically prevent them getting back in.
Yeah, of course. And I guess, you know, using your example of a nurse, you know, there's obviously a huge cognitive demand to, you know, use their knowledge and all of these things that that job entails. But I would imagine there's also quite a sort of hefty physical component of, you know, just physically being on your feet all day and walking around a healthcare centre or a hospital or a surgery or wherever it is. So it's kind of putting the two together, isn't it? It's not just one or the other, it's both at the same time, which is probably going to make it even more difficult. I mean, again, I suppose, you know, I was quite fortunate in some ways that I didn't have the cognitive issues on such a level as it sounds like many of your participants did, and that I noticed that they were worst when I was physically overdoing it as well. So I don't know if that's something that you noticed or measured, the sort of physical symptoms made the cognitive worse, or you know, and then you know, you just said that the cognitive seemed to outlast the physical, certainly in some ways. So that's obviously not the full story, but hey, I'm curious.
Yeah, I mean, I think the physical symptoms and the cognitive issues, there's a complex relationship between the two. And I do think that as the physical symptoms have improved, there have been improvements in the cognitive issues. But then it's very clear to me now that there are quite strong, persistent cognitive issues remaining, even when a lot of the physical aspects are beginning to settle down.
Yeah, so I'd be curious. I mean, you talked about how some of the people that you had in your study were able to return not to their previous roles, but to some form of employment. I think in the UK we call things like, you know, reasonable adjustments. So being able to go down to reduced hours, changing your role, having an office that's closer to the door, working from home. So what have you kind of discovered through those people that has been the most helpful for people returning to work? And I suppose the flip side of that as well, what were the things that stopped them from returning to work that sort of hindered it, I suppose?
So, I mean, the in terms of the 41 adults in the study, there were really four main factors that facilitated a return to work. So, phased returns Now, the standard phased return, you know, your sort of 4 or your 6 week phased return is not working well for adults with long COVID. So where a phased return can extend over a period of months, you know, that really can make a considerable difference. So let me just quote to you here a 47-year-old woman who participated in the study. She said, "What I've learned is that increases in work duties and time spent in work have to happen very slowly, and I need time each time to adjust to the new level of demand." So you can't sort of ratchet up the work demand quickly with a condition like long COVID. The adjustments need to be very small and over a much more extended period of time. So the people who were able to get back into work were the people were they were given much more freedom in terms of the duration of a phased return. So it extended over many more weeks than the standard phased return. Some of the participants also had a change of role. So, you know, the people, the healthcare staff particularly, you know, they were in, prior to their COVID illness, they were in demanding sort of patient-facing roles. Some of them were taken away from those patient-facing roles and were given other roles where they weren't in contact with patients. And having that change of role made a difference as well. And it might be in a role where there were fewer communicative demands. So, you know, that where you maybe didn't have to have a lot of conversations on the phone, or a role where you could sort of be behind the scenes and quietly working away without having to interact and communicate with a lot of people. So changing the role, the phased return was important. The adjustments as well are important. So, you know, working from home, even if it's just for a couple of days a week, it makes a huge difference to someone. So maybe if they can be in work on a Monday and, you know, maybe then working from home on a Tuesday, maybe if they've got the Wednesday off, you know, that sort of pattern makes it much easier for people to get back into the workplace. So working from home, reducing your hours, obviously, the flexibility to reduce hours and, you know, build them up when you feel you can cope with an increase. And then there's a whole range of sort of adaptations. So adaptations to computers, for example. Somebody reported that they had several adjustments. So they were given less responsibilities in work. They were also given a mobility scooter to use. And these adjustments made a vast difference to their ability to perform at work. And then the final factor, Jackie, which was very important, is having strong occupational health support. So, you know, if you've got a strong occupational health worker or consultant in your corner, able to advocate for you with an employer and able to say, look, these are the adjustments that will work, or these are the things that you could do, which would make a return to work easier for this individual, that can make a huge difference as well. So these all sound like very simple things, but, you know, they are really not being implemented very often. I mean, it's actually quite unusual for people to get employers making lots of adjustments and changes. You know, the attitude quite often is, well, you know, we need you here. We need you functioning 100%. We need you 100% of the time. And if you're not able to do that, we can't accommodate you. But actually, you know, you're losing an awful lot of experienced staff, a lot of talented individuals, by just not being a bit more flexible and willing to try and work around these difficulties. And for the employers who are willing to do that, you get the reward in that the individual is able to be reintegrated into the workforce. So, you know, we need to do, I think, a bit of a head shift on how we're treating people with long COVID. And if, you know, if we want to see them back in the workforce, which clearly we do because they form such a large number of people, we need to be better at making accommodations. So those were the things that really helped people. If we're thinking about the barriers or the things that hindered individuals, well, it was really a lack of flexibility and willingness to explore a range of work patterns. So people that have maybe been able to work perfectly well with a couple of days working from home, employers would then say, well, you're no longer allowed to work from home. Well, come on, if they were able to work from home before quite effectively, why did that need to change? That particular work pattern didn't really need to change. So, be accommodating and willing to adopt a range of work patterns. So also there were human resources departments, there were quite a number of individuals were having very stressful face-to-face meetings with human resources. And unfortunately, a number of those interactions were conducted a bit insensitively and were unhelpful. And I always say that even after, the individual maybe makes a recovery or does end up back in the workplace, the thing they will not forget is the insensitive interaction that they maybe had in a meeting with HR professionals. So that has caused a lot of distress to people who are already in considerable distress with their condition. So, we need to think about those sorts of HR encounters as well. Redeployments that were maybe not feasible for the individual with long COVID. So, we're going to give you a redeployment, but they didn't really think about what the individual was saying they couldn't cope with. So, a redeployment that wasn't feasible for the individual just simply escalated stress for them. And unfortunately, quite a number of the individuals with long COVID were working under threats of dismissal if they didn't get back to work. Now, that is acutely stressful on someone who's trying to recover from a chronic illness. So I'll give you an example here of a 59-year-old woman in the study. She said, I returned to work or else was heading for dismissal due to ill health. I returned and worked as stated in my job description, but was told I could have no reasonable adjustments or phased return. I negotiated comfort breaks and time off for medical appointments. And she says, I was ill every day I was in work. Well, that's a miserable situation for any employee to find themselves in.
Yeah, this is really interesting. And I think that, that there are lessons that we've learned over the last 3 and some years. I'm not going to say everybody, because there are some jobs that cannot be done remotely. But there are so many, I would even say the majority possibly, of jobs can be done at least in some form in a remote or hybrid flexible kind of way, and that is evidenced by what happened in March 2020, where suddenly it was like you woke up one morning and you're like, okay, no one goes to work anymore. Okay, I'm going to work from home in my pajamas. There are people that didn't work very well for, which is, I suppose, why it's important that people are able to go and work physically in their office or their place of work. But at the same time, there are very many people who it did work better for to be working flexibly, be that because of illness. And that's not just long COVID. There are plenty of people who were ill with chronic conditions that, predate COVID, that actually flexible working would have made a massive difference for. And this whole situation proved that that was possible. So it should be able to be continued for those people. But for other reasons as well, people who aren't able to get childcare and stuff, if they were able to work flexibly, then actually they would be able to do their job, look after their children and be less stressed, which has got to be a win for everybody, right? So it's kind of like, we've proved that it can be done. Everybody's so desperate to return to normal, whatever normal is, that actually we're kind of overlooking some of, I don't know, some of the benefits, some of the things that we have learned. It was a horrible experience, but surely there's got to be some learning to come out of this and some kind of way forward that, that is better for those people. So that's really, really interesting. But I think your point about the interactions with people at work and how stressful they can be, being chronically unwell is inherently stressful. It is incredibly stressful because you've lost your physical health, you've possibly lost your cognitive ability to do stuff, so your mental health is probably down the toilet. You're struggling with relationships, you're constantly having to rely on other people, and some people don't have those other people. And then you're under stress from work. You're either trying to work and struggling, or you're under threat of dismissal, or you're just worrying about the fact that you can't get back to work and you're not going to have any income, which is not ideal. So there's a huge amount of stress here. And I think, this surely is something that everybody should have, is a bit more empathy. Whether you're having a meeting with HR because you want to change your hours because you have a sick child, or whether you are having a meeting with HR and your boss because you are chronically unwell and you're trying to work out how you might be able to return to work and what that looks like. It's that there needs to be a level of empathy and understanding and sort of listening, understanding, asking questions, but kind of gently, curiously, rather than with this kind of blame. Because I think you're right, if somebody is experiencing all of this stress and then they think, okay, well, maybe there could be a way for me to return to work. I would really like to, I need to, but it's got to be in a way that works for me. And then you come up against a boss in an HR department that basically sits there and you feel like they're accusing you of things, or forcing you to do things that you're not able to do, or just being generally inflexible. I think the way, it's not just what people say, it's the way they say it that can be very, very important, I think. So yeah, I think that's a really big point.
We'll be right back. Hey there, I'm just jumping in for a second to see if you're enjoying this episode. If you're finding it useful, maybe you would consider sharing it somewhere, a friend, a group, or even on your Twitter feed. If everyone was able to share just once, we'd be able to get this information out to even more people who really, really need it. So please consider sharing somewhere if you possibly can. I hope you enjoy the episode, and thank you so much.
Yeah, if your listeners access the testimonials in the show notes to the podcast, you can hear firsthand accounts there of just how difficult some of these workplace interactions have been, and the damage that is done when people are not dealt with sensitively in the workplace, because it is significant and it adds a terrible stress to people who are already very unwell and stressed with their condition.
Yeah, which is in itself going to hinder recovery, isn't it? I imagine if somebody has a stressful HR meeting and maybe they do manage to hash out something that they are able to do some sort of return to work, that return to work is going to be far more stressful and far, less conducive to good health and recovery if they've got that hanging over their head, that was a really nasty meeting and that they're kind of there under duress almost. That's going to make a bad situation worse, isn't it? And I guess we put a lot on employers, and they can be made out to be the bad guys in all of this. And, for sure, some of them are, maybe even quite a lot of them are. But I think maybe there's something in here about education as well, because I mean, I've definitely noticed this myself over the last few years, that I think I have a level of empathy that I didn't before, because I understand on some level what it feels like to be these people. I know what it feels like to be so physically unwell, so struggling mentally, to not be able to work, all of these things. So I understand that, whereas I like to think I would have been empathetic before, but I certainly wouldn't have understood. So I think education for employers, for HR departments, not in a kind of patronizing way, just in a kind of, how can we do better? How can we be better to these people who are struggling for whatever reason? Because that's going to be better for everybody. It's going to make a better place for people to work. More people are going to be able to return to work. And as you said earlier, less of that loss of experience, because just because these people are unwell doesn't mean that they're useless. It just means that they're not able to do exactly the same thing that they were before at the moment. So we don't want to lose them.
And I mean, many of these issues have already, been historically experienced by people with chronic fatigue syndrome. So, people with other chronic conditions, chronic illnesses have, encountered these types of workplace interactions. And the long COVID people are now seeing firsthand what this is like. So yes, I think there needs to be better efforts at educating employers about the potential that these individuals have if there can be a degree of flexibility to try and work them back into employment.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, I think we've sort of just touched on this really with what we've just been talking about, but are there sort of specific things that people with long COVID, or other chronic conditions would sort of change about returning to work and maybe the process or the things that they ask for? Or I don't know, I mean, that's quite a wide open question, isn't it?
I think it is just, it's about attitudes and willingness to try and listen to what they're saying and just try to be a bit more flexible. I know it's very difficult for employers, especially, if you're maybe working in a highly stressed health environment where you need to be able to rely on a certain number of trained staff to be available for employment. I do understand the pressures from the employer end. But I think if we could just be a bit more flexible and think about what changes we can make. They don't need to be massive changes. They really don't need to be massive changes. A degree of small changes sometimes can make a huge amount of difference to the work experience of somebody. And I would say that that is sort of the overriding message from people with long COVID, certainly in my study, that a willingness to believe that what they're experiencing, first of all, is real, because of course a lot of it was dismissed as not proper illness, as it were, and not just a belief that it exists, but a willingness to accommodate and be a bit more flexible to allow work re-entry. Those sorts of changes would make a huge difference to the employment outcomes of people with long COVID, I believe.
Yeah, and I think, if we look at the, hopefully, people are able to return to work in some form and the employers are flexible and all of these things. But, if there was someone who tried to return to work and they had meetings with their boss, with their HR, and, these departments, they were willing to try. And they offered things and they discussed it with the person and they made an effort. And maybe it doesn't work, maybe the person isn't able to return to their job. But I think it's going to make a big difference to that person that they tried, that then if they do end up leaving, that they leave knowing that their boss, that their employer really made an effort for them.
Because we do have to recognize that some people, even with adjustments, will not be able to get back into work. And I think people can accept that as long as they can see that there has been some effort made to try and accommodate them. Whereas I think the experience too often is there was no effort made, and people were just fairly quickly moved on to the point at which, they were effectively removed from their posts. So, people can accept that they can't get back into work if they are given some degree of accommodation and there is a willingness to try and be flexible with them.
Yeah, it comes back to the sort of the willingness, flexibility, people trying, making an effort, the empathy, I suppose, doesn't it? That can just, the end result may not be any different, but everybody is going to feel a lot better about it. And I think that is big, I think. Cool. I feel like we've packed a ton in here. So what's next? Is there more plans for more studies, more research, more write-ups?
Yeah, so I'm bringing to conclusion on quite a big study, actually. It's an international study. It has 4,302 adults in it. So it was a survey conducted, obviously, online. So these adults are from 62 countries. The survey could be completed in 21 different languages because, my previous work has obviously largely been with people in the UK, English speakers. People of white ethnicity, of certain sort of educational background. So I wanted to try and open it out. This is obviously a huge long COVID is a global public health problem affecting adults, children and adults Everywhere, absolutely everywhere. So I wanted to get a wider perspective, a global perspective on what was happening with language communication, cognition. So this study, I'm at the stage of really writing it up. The data has been collected and it's being analysed, and I'm at the point of writing it up. So I want to use this particular piece of work, Jackie, to find out if there are subtypes of brain fog. So, you know, we've talked about these cognitive linguistic difficulties, but these are really a constellation of different cognitive and language problems. And I want to see, do they sort of naturally coalesce into groups or subtypes to see if there are maybe a subtype of brain fog where there's a predominance of language symptoms, or is there a subtype of brain fog where there's a predominance of memory problems, things like that. So that's one of the issues I'm trying to address through this study. But also I want to analyze in considerable detail what is the exact association between different types of brain fog and the employment outcomes for people with long COVID, because the follow-up study, you know, while I did look at employment, we didn't, you know, look at it in any sort of statistically rigorous way. But the study that I'm currently working on now is doing that more rigorous statistical analysis to see what is the exact role of brain fog in the employment outcomes of people with long COVID. So that will eventually be published, and I will make it available to you and your listeners if you wish to have a copy of it.
Amazing. Yeah, I mean, that'd be lovely. So depending on when people are listening, that may be available. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been amazing catching up, hearing what you've been up to, the results that you've got, testimonials from the people that you've been working with as well, because, you know, that lived experience input, I think, is so, so valuable. So all the links that you've mentioned and the recordings of the testimonials and things, that will all be in the links in the show notes if people want to follow that up. So yeah, thank you so much. Good luck with the analysing of the writing up of the study. And maybe we can catch up again at some point when you've got some more results. That would be lovely.
Absolutely, Jackie. Well, look, thank you very much indeed. And I mean, if any of your listeners feel they want to contact me, you know, please do make my email address available at the university, and I'm happy to receive correspondences from any of your listeners.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much to all of my guests and to you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed it, or at least found it useful. The Long COVID podcast is entirely self-produced and self-funded. I'm doing all of this myself. If you're able to, please go to buymeacoffee.com/longcovidpod to help me cover the costs of hosting the podcast. Please look out for the next episode of the Long COVID podcast. It's available on all the usual podcast hosting things. And do get in touch